Hello, and welcome back to Agents of Impact, a podcast from Impact Alpha. I'm David Bank, editor and CEO, and I'm joined by co-host Sherelle Dorsey, contributing editor to Impact Alpha. Welcome back, Sherelle.
Hey, David. Great to be back.
This is another in our series of conversations with agents of impact across the landscape of impact investing, sustainable finance, venture capital, private equity, and of course, founders and entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I love that you identify these folks as agents of impact and just the fact that you add them to the brief 5 days a week. It's pretty remarkable to get to know who these folks are and also be able to hear more about their stories and the work that they're doing.
Yeah, what brings them all together is this shared mission around impact. It sometimes seems like a precious or fleeting thing in this world. And folks are feeling a little angsty now, I would say. So we reached out to Allison Taylor at NYU, an old friend and colleague, and she's the author of a new book, How Business Can Do the Right Thing in a Turbulent World.
It was definitely a fascinating conversation. I'm curious, what stood out for you, David?
Well, she was a little, I wouldn't say downbeat, but maybe realistic in the sense of how change can happen. I think she's been frustrated by the lack of progress on some of these issues. She's been at it for quite a long time. Like, for example, there's a theory out there that, you know, if we just have increased transparency and companies report on all kinds of things, you know, from climate, obviously, to diversity, to worker issues and things, gender issues, that somehow that will then lead to, you know, some kind of accountability, and that will lead then to some kind of, you know, action plans, and that will lead to real change. And she was basically saying she hadn't seen the change yet. So we've got all this transparency, we've got all this reporting, but where's the change?
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to hear from Allison, her expertise, and also about her new book and the conversation you all had. So let's go ahead and jump in.
Hi, Allison Taylor. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Allison, I'm delighted to speak with you. I was hoping you could sort of give us a little bit of a level set about where we are in this whole kind of multi-decade progression towards maybe a different way of doing business, a different way of doing investing. And you're kind of perfectly positioned. You've been 25 or so years as a consultant to companies and now as a professor at the Stern School at NYU. Maybe just take it at a high level, kind of where are we in this journey?
I mean, I think the first thing we can say to answer this question is that debates about what the role of business in society should be are perennial. In my class, we read Cicero writing about this in Roman times, and I don't think this debate is going anywhere or going to be resolved anytime soon. But if we zero in on the last several decades, we have, as everybody knows, we had this Milton Friedman consensus, right? The purpose of business is to maximize value for shareholders and not break the law. And that frame came initially with the idea, therefore, that if you're going to do something ethical, you firstly need to go beyond compliance and that this will come at the detriment of returns. So when we first start seeing responsible investing and corporate sustainability, these were framed in very normative terms. You know, we want to do something about companies investing in South Africa, or we want to do something about civil rights. And the widespread acceptance was that if you're trying to drive social or environmental goals, that will in some way be traded off against your returns. So what is very interesting is that in around 2004, so 2004 is when the term ESG was coined at the UN. 2006 is when this very, very influential article, Creating Shared Value, was written by corporate strategy professor Michael Porter. So what happens in the early 2000s is people start to say, well, maybe doing the right thing for the environment and society doesn't need to come at the expense of returns. Maybe there isn't a trade-off between shareholders and stakeholders. Maybe we can do the right thing for the planet and make more money. So we can think about this. It's been called the era of cakeism in the last few days, we can think about this as the win-win era, the idea that you can do well by doing good, the triple bottom line, many, many kind of similar concepts out there.
Cakeism is a reference to you can have your cake and eat it too, yes?
Exactly. So we don't need to do anything difficult or uncomfortable. We can maximize value for investors and save the planet at the same time. So these ideas get a lot of traction during the 2010s and particularly during the Trump administration for various reasons we can get into if you like. I think there's a key tipping point in Larry Fink's January 2018 letter where he directly challenges Friedman and says now businesses need to not only create shareholder value but show how they create a positive contribution to society. August 2019, we have the Business Roundtable saying companies exist to create value for all stakeholders. And so we can think of right before the pandemic as being the peak of these ideas. Since then, quite obviously, things have got a lot more uncomfortable and a lot more fraught. And so now I think we're in an era, I hope we're in an era of more sobriety, more restraint, and more acknowledgement that what everybody needs to be doing is grappling with fiendishly difficult trade-offs.
And you've just written a book and come out with a book called Higher Ground, How Business Can Do the Right Thing in a Turbulent World, I guess to help guide business leaders through this turbulence. What's the main message of the book?
So, I mean, I wrote the book because I kind of felt like I was going crazy and that there was this raging debate or multiple threads of a debate that has become so chaotic we don't even have a word to describe what the debate is about. Interestingly, no one really likes the idea of business ethics. We know that ESG is being shaped and reshaped and has become a sort of proxy vehicle for a lot of very politicized battles. You hear this term purpose, which has become very jargony, and branding consultants like it. So we're having a conversation, a debate, a discussion about what the role of business in society should be, but we don't even have words to frame the discussion. And I felt that the conversation was getting so confusing and so odd that I thought I would rashly try to clear things up by writing a book about this. The second thing that I think is really fascinating is the way that corporations have a domain and a function called usually ethics and compliance that deals with regulatory risk. And then they have a domain or a function called sustainability or corporate citizenship or ESG, which is thought to deal with stakeholders and with these kind of ideas of going beyond compliance and doing good for the world. It's fascinating and I think incredibly revealing that those functions do not have anything to do with each other historically. They have different philosophies, jargon, frameworks, and approaches. That starts to become very difficult in the era we're in today, where you start to see ESG disclosures becoming regulated, particularly in the EU, fairly aggressively. And so that traditional frame of how we think about ESG efforts as going beyond compliance doesn't make any sense anymore. And there are lots and lots of questions about internal governance and culture and strategy and prioritization, and specifically the gap between what businesses say they're doing and what they are in fact doing.
So are you, there's sort of a contradiction here or a perplexity, which is that you're saying as the disclosure and transparency requirements, as you say, in the EU, but also coming, you know, through the SEC and out here in California in various ways, you're saying that's actually set back the effort to kind of go beyond just mere compliance. Maybe compliance has become so burdensome that that's all folks can do.
I'm not saying it's set it back necessarily. I mean, I think that's an ongoing debate and we'll have to see how it plays out. I'm just saying that thinking about the world as you have a group of people that focus on not breaking the law and then a separate group of people that focus on glossy sustainability reports and voluntary disclosure and nice stories about how, all the wonderful things we're doing, that separation doesn't make any sense once you start regulating ESG. So then you've got a lot of very difficult questions about where you put these functions and what jobs you have everybody doing and who coordinates with who. Sustainability people, I think, tend to look down on compliance and regard this as kind of table stakes and something easy and black and white. That's never really been true. But the bigger problem is these two worlds don't speak the same language. And so corporations and corporate leaders, I think, are really struggling to understand the point of all these pressures and to put in place genuinely holistic approaches.
Let's just stick on disclosure and transparency for a second, because, you know, Impact Alpha has always been kind of an ecumenical, platform, in the sense that folks might say, as you say, that, you know, sort of mere disclosure is table stakes and doesn't really get to transformative change. We've always had the position that it at least sets the table and allows watchdogs, the press or shareholders or others, to hold companies to account. And so therefore it's sort of, you know, step one, and step two might be, you know, going further and being more proactive. But are you saying that that sort of logic or that theory of change is not really operative anymore?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't want people to understand that I'm against transparency. As you rightly point out, if we go back to the 90s, let's say, what companies were saying about sustainability topics was limited to non-existent. And if they did say anything, it was completely inconsistent and completely, somewhere between difficult and impossible to compare what was going on. That said, I think we have drifted into a situation where we are effectively treating disclosure as an end in itself. It's fascinating to go back to the founding declarations of the Carbon Disclosure Project, for example. And it sort of says, you know, back in 2000, we've got all these investors backing this. We're going to get corporations to disclose, and then we're going to tackle the climate crisis. So I just think it's fascinating. It's now 24 years later, we are still arguing about who should have to disclose what, and we have not actually progressed to action. In the meantime, an enormous army of accountants and analysts and consultants and lawyers has developed to manage all this disclosure. The biggest problem, I think, is that we don't pay nearly enough attention to the role of the recipient of the information. So we're getting sort of stuck at the accountability stage. We seem to be assuming that, the average consumer, the average employee, even an informed investor can somehow navigate through these disclosures and tell some story about whether the company is good or bad. And then we're assuming that there's some kind of accountability mechanism. So all of this, I think, also rests on something that is really a fantasy, which is that reputational risk is some kind of linear accountability mechanism. So we're telling companies this story: just disclose everything you're doing, you'll have more stakeholder trust, you will have more stakeholder support, that will build your social license to operate, that will generate returns. And this story, I'm not saying it's baseless, but it is not really true. Business disclosures are getting exponentially more complex and difficult to interpret, even when the company isn't deliberately obfuscating or greenwashing. So it's becoming harder and harder to evaluate this stuff. It drives a tendency to think we can divide the world into good or bad and bad companies, as if a company has a single brain and personality, whereas in fact, a company is a system and nobody is good at everything. It drives this fear of being honest and transparent about what your challenges actually are, because we've told companies that these disclosures are going to be how investors rate you and score and allocate capital. And then we feel angry and frustrated that what we get is a bunch of greenwashing and storytelling and sustainability acting as the paramilitary wing of the marketing department. I don't think we should be at all surprised by that, given the incentives we've put in the system and the story we're telling corporate leaders about what the point of all this is. I think the second point is that, you know, we've told ourselves this story that transparency will lead to more trust and transparency will lead to better behavior. Well, I don't know about you. I've never lived in such an untrustworthy era. So we have more and more and more and more transparency, and it doesn't seem to be doing what we claim it's doing.
In addition to all of that, there's been this ferocious backlash. So some of the critique or some of the complications come not from the intrinsic logic, as we were discussing, but from an actual kind of political agenda. So some of the Climate Action 100 kind of withdrawals were motivated also by charges from the House Judiciary Committee that such collaborations might be an antitrust violation and those sort of things, and not really related to the the sort of business efficacy of such measures, but of, you know, sort of just maybe finger in the wind of where the politics are at.
Yeah, I mean, I think the right wing has calculated that the average voter who's not super informed on the topics we spend all day thinking about will kind of wake up and be like, yeah, now you mention it, Target and Coca-Cola have got a bit woke lately. I think I'll vote Republican. I think that is basically the calculation. It's clearly a bad faith argument because the crux of the argument is caring about environmental and social issues, accounting for them, is somehow a breach of fiduciary duty, and business just needs to stick to business and stay out of politics. But whatever you do, keep the campaign finance and lobbying dollars flowing. So I don't think we can take those arguments seriously. What's maybe more controversial to your listeners or less discussed is I have, and maybe not as much, but I have quite a bit of a problem as well with the way that the left and more progressive voices have pitched to companies. I hear really interesting things in the classroom these days along the lines of, why would I take the time to vote in a gerrymandered system? Why would I bother engaging in politics? I've got no agency, I've got no influence, but I can go and get a job and I can pressure a brand, I can pressure my employer to do something about these topics, and that will in some way give me some voice and some agency. So we've almost started to argue on the left that stakeholders are like an electorate and corporations are like governments, and we should, can somehow gather stakeholder views and represent stakeholder positions as corporate leaders. And I think that's very, very dangerous. You hear kind of people saying all these things, corporations need to stand up for this and stand up for that and use their leverage. And that is a sort of political interference in a different way. And I wouldn't say it's caused the backlash, but I don't think it has been helpful that many, many corporations have got into this sort of grandiose over-promising about the problems that they can take on and the problems they can actually solve. If you look at Unilever's recent materiality maps, for example, they include topics like inequality and poverty and global trade and even women, which are broad, baggy topics of questionable questionable relevance and questionable degree of leverage if you are a company that makes soap and mayonnaise and ice cream.
I'm Eric Carmen Gonzalez, Impact Alpha's Director of Subscription Growth. Ever feel like there's so much happening it's hard to keep up? We hear you. That's why we created Impact Alpha Latin America, a monthly newsletter for impact investors who want to keep their eye on trends and investments happening in Latin America and the Caribbean. Follow the money and connect with agents of impact powering Latin America's impact economy. Visit our Instagram page at Impact Alpha and click on the link in our bio to sign up.
Some of these things are, you know, considered, you know, systemic risks. I mean, climate being foremost among them, but maybe income inequality as well, or gender issues, and certainly racial issues. How are companies supposed to deal with these things that are sort of outside of their direct control, as you say, but also still, you know, either risk factors or sort of just, you know, business environment that they're operating in?
Yeah, so all of this feeds into the, you know, the universal owner thesis, which is the argument for why people like Larry Fink care about this stuff in general. If you're exposed to the whole economy, then of course issues like climate change and the future of democracy and inequality become issues for your portfolio. But I think, you know, I think the problem is where we start to put pressure on corporations to act like governments when they don't have the structures or mechanisms to represent their stakeholders. And we take very important energy and credibility away from the political process. So the first thing most companies can do is to stop contradicting themselves with their political spending. It is relatively commonplace to be out there yodeling about how much you care about climate change or reproductive rights while your government relations team down the hall is spending money in a completely different direction. So quite honestly, until that issue is resolved, I don't think corporations have any business saying that they can solve any of these systemic societal challenges.
That does tend to be one of the areas where disclosure is important, is to understand where the political contributions are going.
Right.
And
AT&T has just been dragged reluctantly into publishing this political congruency report. So we're starting to see more pressure there. But, you know, let's just be clear. Most companies have put out these sustainability reports implying that they are making efforts to solve these problems, whereas their political spending does not reflect those priorities. I think the second thing you can do is to focus on ideally 1 to 3 issues directly relevant to how your business makes money and try to have a focused strategy. There is an overwhelming tendency to tick the box on 40 things, to have a giant laundry list of issues, to treat ESG reporting frameworks as a guide to strategy when they're a terrible guide to strategy, and so on. So that's the first thing I would say, is to have sharper priorities and be much more focused and much clearer about what is a risk, what's an opportunity, and what is a negative externality, even if it may not yet be a risk. Now, those sharp priorities will not leave you off the hook for any issue relating to culture, social identity, you know, gender, race, psychological safety, anything related to people in your organization and your wider ecosystem. No company can say that's got nothing to do with me. If you employ people, then you've got to do something about those topics. But those would be my my suggestions. Get your political spending ducks in a row. Be more focused and realistic and honest about the problems that you take on, and then take a human rights focused approach to your culture.
And just on that last one, I mean, that seems to be, as you say, right in the can of companies, their workers, and that has become, you know, a more focused issue as I think the labor market has tightened up, as people's expectations have gone up, as the COVID sort of pandemic has rolled through, and people have kind of, you know, reassessed their life choices or their lifestyle, work at home and other kinds of things. So are companies now able to think more holistically about their, you know, human capital, their human resources, the workers as assets? That would seem to be within their control.
I think it is within their control. You may well agree with me that it's a bit of a mess out there at the moment. I would agree we're in a new era of worker rights and worker voice. That's often tied to the structure of the labor market. I mean, there's a sort of fascinating argument that cuts on immigration during the Trump administration have led to this new era on worker rights. So such a fascinating topic, given the kind of second order and first order consequences of policies we think are good. But I tend to think that the young people's expectations and young people's willingness to challenge leadership and then undercut corporate narratives on social media and in the public domain mean we're in a new era where worker voice needs to be taken seriously, regardless of the structure of the labor market. So I think there are fairly profound generational shifts going on here. If you are a member of Gen Z, at this point, you know, most of them don't even remember what corporate culture was like before the pandemic. So we are reshaping our organizations in real time, whether that's remote work, whether that is the focus on mental health, whether it's corporations speaking up on diversity issues or ESG issues. There are a number of indicators. I think the underlying thread is that there is increasingly an expectation among young people that the corporation should adapt to me rather than the other way around. So the personal has become professional, and the professionals become personal. And I think most corporate leaders are really struggling to manage this.
And just to kind of bring it to a close, I mean, would you argue, you know, a lot of these things are sort of mandates or expectations or prohibitions, you know, on bad behavior, but isn't there a positive, you know, advantage to be had, you know, alpha, as it were, in, you know, looking out, you know, further ahead, looking out at global trends, looking out at labor trends, doing the right thing for your workers in order to have better retention or higher morale, as the case may be, you know, being a climate leader because that's where the world is going in terms of a low carbon transition. Can't companies still, you know, regardless of what the rules are or the laws are, you know, gain an advantage by kind of being out front on some of these trends that do seem to, you know, be coming home to roost?
I think we're on the same page. I couldn't agree more with everything you've said, but for that to happen, we need to see these issues as strategic. We need to see them as strategic rather than PR. We need to see them as strategic rather than compliance box ticking reporting exercises. And being strategic means that you also must choose what you're not going to do. So I think the big concern I have right now as all these regulations start to gain steam is that there are more and more compliance tick box voices becoming involved, more and more legal neuroses, and many, many forces weighing against the strategic approach, which is, I think, precisely what companies do need and which you just articulated brilliantly.
Well, maybe we're into cakeism 2.0. I don't know whether that's...
I think we're in an era of sober, restrained consideration of trade-offs and anchoring on treating workers with dignity and respect. But that might be my hope.
David, that was such a fascinating conversation. I feel like I learned a great deal from Allison. I can't wait to actually grab her book. But what were your key takeaways from that now that you're, you know, listening into the conversation again?
Well, I tried to steer her back to, you know, the alpha in impact, as we call it, you know, the things that actually do drive value so everybody can get behind it. You can call it win-win, but you can also say just these are like sort of logical and obvious things that have somehow been forgotten. The most obvious one is, you know, treat your workers well, and you know, they'll do better, and you'll do better. And I think that comes through in so many different ways all across the landscape.
Absolutely. I think that's super poignant. Once again, it's great to just be on this podcast. I'm glad it's back and just being able to really dissect and digest these conversations with Agents of Impact.
Well, it's a pleasure doing it with you, Sherelle. Thank you. And for listeners, I just want to remind you, we'll be bringing you more conversations with Agents of Impact. You can see all of the shows in the Impact Alpha podcasting network at impactalpha.com, and make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Awesome. Catch you next time.